Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you most want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you most want to lead. Author Magazine, Author, is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org, and we are funded by the great Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. If you want to learn more about the PNWA and their writers' conference, it's the 25th of July. It's just a little over a week away, but I know there's still a few slots left. If you want to jump in there, you can learn more about the PNWA and their conference at pnwa.org. Well, you know, writers, we're creative people, make our living using our creativity. But sometimes creativity can feel sort of like a bird that just visited you or visits you from time to time. And sometimes it stays for a long time and sometimes a short time. Sometimes it sings a very sweet song and sometimes not so sweet. But it can seem almost random, I guess you could say. But I've come to the opinion that creativity is actually more like the muscles in your body, in that you are born with it, just like you are born with those muscles. And just like those muscles, you can learn to use your creativity, learn to use it more powerfully and more effectively in such a way, I think, that the bird can stay longer and longer and longer and sing a sweeter and sweeter song. And just like any other skill or any other muscle, you can sometimes use a coach to improve those skills, and which is why I'm so glad I have on our show today Mr. Eric Maisel, PhD, probably the foremost creativity coach in the United States of America, and author most recently of Making Your Creative Mark, 9 Keys to Achieving Your Artistic Goals. Eric is, in addition to being a creativity coach, also a prolific writer, has written more than 40 books, including Coaching the Artist Within and the Van Gogh Blues. Eric, welcome to the show.
Hi, Bill. How are you doing? I'm getting all kinds of bird images as you're talking.
Good. I am doing great. I'm doing just great. Well, so, Eric, for some of our listeners, they may have never heard of a creativity coach, and they may be curious about what it is and why they might want one. What is a creativity coach as opposed to a tennis coach? Or a track coach?
Well, I'm not very good at tennis, so that's probably why I'm a creativity coach. A creativity coach works with creative performing artists or anybody who's creative on all of the issues we face, whether it's getting the work done, getting the work into the marketplace, emotional issues like existential sadness and anxiety and even addictions. Everything that comes up for a creative person, a creative coach can work on those issues.
Right. And so it's different than, say, someone who my wife for a long time took, or for a short time, I guess, took singing lessons. She went to a singing instructor, and that instructor walked her through how to hit the notes and so on. So this is less specific to the craft and more to the entire creative experience, both emotional and professional. Is that right?
That's right. And it's process oriented. We don't look at your paintings or your writing, and we don't attend your performances unless we want to. But it's not about looking at the work. It's helping you get the work done, helping you deal with any resistance or blocks to getting the work done. A lot of what people present are just the most ordinary issues of not getting to the work regularly and not working deeply, having trouble with a noisy mind that's preventing them from having the big ideas they want to have, et cetera.
Yeah. You know what it reminds me of, Eric, is I interviewed a writer recently, Gregory Martin, who wrote whose memoir, Stories for Boys, was recently a Seattle Reads Choice, and I interviewed him when he came through here. And he told his story about how his first memoir had been a New York Times notable book, and it had gotten, and Barnes & Noble made a big deal out of it, and he was still a young man, only 4 years out of his MFA program, and everything was going swimmingly. And he assumed, well, this is it. This is how the writer's career, at least mine, will go. And then his next book, The Novel, did not sell. He wrote it and wrote it. His agent took out everybody and it didn't sell. He wrote another 18 that still didn't sell. And he was wondering, well, what's up? What am I doing? He was teaching creative writing in the MFA program himself, but this wasn't happening. And eventually he found Stories for Boys, which is his next memoir, and sold it. But what he said to me in the interview was this, which is why I bring it up. He said, I've come to believe, and even though he teaches an MFA writing program, which is very craft-centric, he's come to believe that the psychological challenges or the psychological mastery in the end is far more important than the technical mastery that artists deal with all the time. Does that make sense?
Sure, and one of the psychological pieces is the maturity to understand that only a percentage of our work is going to work. You know, you may turn out a beautiful book the first time, and you may turn out a stinker the second time. That's the reality of process. And most people don't want to think about that or honor process that way. Everybody has the hope that the thing that they're tackling is going to be excellent, but only a percentage of the work we do is going to be excellent. We have to be thinking more of our body of work than the thing in front of us. Obviously, we want the thing in front of us to be good, but we can't get so attached that if it doesn't turn out good, we give up the game. Lots of first-time authors do that. They make a hash of their first book, which people should do. It shouldn't be that easy to write a first book. Making a hash of your first book sounds very natural, but a lot of people give up at that point because they start bad-mouthing themselves. They call it a matter of the lack of talent or one thing or another as opposed to what it is, namely pure process.
That's right. You know, one of the things that helped me so much with that, Eric, was when I started writing my daily column for Author Magazine. So I write this 5 days a week. I write a 400-word blog column for the magazine. And when I decided I was going to do that, I was a rather meticulous writer. I said to myself, I do not want to spend 2 hours every day writing this column. I've got other stuff I want to do. So I'm only going to give myself 45 minutes, and I'll do the best I can in 45 minutes. And what I found is that cured me of my perfectionism in a way, because I just didn't have time to try to perfect it. Instead, I had time to learn how to write well in 45 minutes. And over 4 or 5 years, those pieces have gotten better and better and better. And I've allowed them to be what they were. Yeah?
Absolutely. Does that make sense? I think that kind of, let's call it demand or invitation to do something more quickly rather than slowly is a wonderful invitation. People often take far too long on the work they're doing. Some ways because they don't want to complete things. If you complete things, then you have to judge it. You have to put it out in the marketplace.
Yeah.
So it's easy to keep things not completed. I often use the story of Simenon, the Belgian writer who wrote the Maigret series, who wrote most of his books in 3 weeks' time. Not to sell clients on the idea that books should be written in 3 weeks, but just to get them over the idea that books need to take 2 years or 4 years or 8 years or 14 years.
Yeah.
You know, we can demand of ourselves to do things a little more quickly. And as you say, that can be really liberating, really helpful, really motivational.
Yeah. You know, when I interviewed Richard Bach, he was talking about rejection. And he said he had the story in his head, and I'm sure you have to coach, especially writers, who you coach on rejection. I'm sure that comes up. But he was talking about rejection. Yeah, right. But all artists, right? They got to know someone's going to say no to you. But he said, told me an interesting story. Maybe it was apocryphal, but this is what he said, that he had a story that a writer gets a certain number of rejections. That's just the story. And so he got them, and then he stopped getting them. But he got the rejections he told himself he would get. And then he met Truman Capote, and he said Truman Capote didn't believe in rejections, and according to Truman Capote, he never got them because he just didn't believe he was ever going to get them. Now, this is not to say that writers should beat themselves up for getting rejection, but there is a certain amount of expectation that can invite a certain level of rejection. Have you found that to be with your clients or not?
Well, I think the way I would say it, and I don't know how Truman Capote quite pulled that off, but
I don't know. I'm reminded
of Pearl Buck's story. Somebody was shadowing her, doing an interview of her when she was in her 70s, and she had sent out some short story, and it was rejected, and the interviewer said, "You still get rejected?" And she said, "Well, yes, I'm a writer." And I think we do need the maturity to embrace the idea that we're going to be criticized, that it's going to be pushback from the world, that we're going to face rejection. I don't think it pays to create a vision or a story where we don't get rejected. We're going to get rejected. The goals are to build a really thick skin so that the emotional battering lasts only 3 seconds as opposed to 2 months, know, we're going to have an emotional reaction when the rejection email comes in, or more usually when there's just pure silence. We're going to have an emotional reaction to that. But I think one of the keys is learning how to get over those feelings as quickly as possible and move right on to continuing the work.
Well, speaking of getting over it, I want to talk about the 9 keys to achieving your artistic goals, and you break them down one by one, and then, I want to start with the first one, actually, which I think I'm glad you led with it, because I think it, in many ways, for me, it's always been the most important, which is the mind key. What is the mind key to achieving your
artistic goals? I do start there. As you say, the other 8 maybe could go in any old order, but the mind key actually does come first. And there are lots of things to be said about why we should be thinking thoughts that serve us and how to think thoughts that serve us. But I want to make just one point, and that is writers, but everybody, are held hostage by true thoughts. If they think a thought that's true, they think they have to countenance it just because it's true. And that's one of the biggest mistakes we can make. And what I mean is, let's say it's a Monday and you're writing and you have the idle thought that there are a lot of writers out there. Completely true thought,
right?
And that's absolutely a thought that doesn't serve you. And if you just let that thought fester, boy, there are a lot of writers out there, on Wednesday you're going to stop writing. You won't even know what happened.
Yeah.
So we have to be very careful about allowing even true thoughts their place in our brain. When you hear a thought like, boy, there are a lot of writers out there, you have to instantly dispute that, not its veracity, but its usefulness to you, and say,
right,
it doesn't serve me to think that. And then to substitute some more positive or affirmative or useful language like back to work or whatever it is that we say to ourselves to deal with thoughts that don't serve us. Folks are thinking thoughts that don't serve them all day long, and you think enough of them and you're going to stop doing your work pretty soon.
Yeah, it's absolutely true, Eric. And one of the ways I became more productive as a writer was when I got serious about paying attention to what I was thinking when I was writing.
Mm-hmm.
Just paying attention to what I was thinking. Like, you know, the critic, for instance, of course, this is what writers have to deal with all the time. Am I listening to him deliberately or unconsciously? Because when I listen to him unconsciously, he just makes a mess of what I'm doing. But when I'm aware that he's talking, I can either listen or disregard him. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And I think you said that one of your issues, which you got over by giving yourself those 45-minute deadlines, was, quote, perfectionism, which is an anxiety state. Perfectionism
sure
is an anxiety state, and the thing that you're talking about has to do with the anxiety that threads its way throughout the creative process. If we're not aware that the process makes us anxious, that our self-talk makes us anxious, then we're going to stall more often than not. And if you think about it, you know, creating is one choice after another. Writing is one choice after another. You know, put the comma in, take the comma out, send your character to Zanzibar or Paris. These are all choices, and choosing provokes anxiety. So we're never going to get away from anxiety in the process because we have to make one choice after another, and choosing provokes anxiety. So we need some good anxiety management skills to lead the writing life. It could be something as simple as knowing how to do a little deep breathing. It can be complicated stuff. But whatever it is, we need something more effective than what's the number one thing we do when anxiety rears its head? We flee the encounter. We run like heck.
Right.
And writers are running away from the writing all the time just because there's a little anxiety there. So we don't want that as our way to deal with anxiety, running away. We don't want alcohol and drugs to be our way of dealing with anxiety. We want smarter things. But we need something because the anxiety is there.
Yeah, it is. I've told the story a couple of times, but one of the most triumphant moments I had as a writer recently was when I spent an hour and a half not writing. And the reason it was triumphant for me was not because I didn't think, but because I knew I don't like to dive in and start writing quickly sometimes. I want to kind of have a sense of where I'm going. And I let myself sit there for a pen without typing about an hour and a half, saying, this is creative too. And when I see the thing the way I want to see it, I know I will be able to write, which I did after the hour and a half. But normally I told all this story about what I was doing and a better writer wouldn't do this and what's wrong with you and all the whatever you can come up with. At that time, to not write and be kind to myself, I was elated after I stepped away from the desk.
Absolutely. You know, so much of what's true for us is that the proof is in the pudding. There can't be rules about whether to write in the morning or in the evening or on a typewriter or on a computer or in longhand.
Right.
There can't be rules, but we have to be honest. We have to be truthful and mature. And if we start to scribble too soon, then maybe sitting on our hands is what we need to do. If we don't write enough words, we need to write more words. You know, we need to know what's true for us to look ourselves in the mirror and do the things that make sense for us.
Yeah, I always say to people, you're not learning how to write a book, you're learning how to write your book. Because how you write your book is going to be how different than I write my book. So you got to learn what is your book.
That's right. But, you know, if a client isn't doing the work and is providing too many excuses for why that's happening, you know, then I'll try to arm wrestle a little about other ways of going. Like you were talking about, you know, the bird arriving and what have you. Tchaikovsky has a lovely quote, which is, I'm inspired about every fifth day, but I only get that fifth day if I show up the other 4 days. And
yes.
I think that's true. I mean, you're right that inspiration only comes, you know, when it comes, but it won't come at all if we're not showing up.
No, it won't.
If clients are saying, well, you know, I think I can only write in 2016 when my next bout of inspiration will come, you know, I have to arm wrestle with that and argue that it's probably not going to come in 2016 if you're not showing up now.
Absolutely. Which, in a way, for me, brings us to the next, not the next in your order, but the one I'd like to talk about next, which is the passion key, which is something I sort of discovered for myself is very critical to my process. Tell us about the passion key.
Yeah, Pavarotti has a quote I like, which is, people say I'm disciplined, but it's not discipline, it's devotion, and there's a big difference. I think that's true. I don't think we can white-knuckle creativity. I don't think you can, via discipline, spend 3 years on a novel. I think you actually have to be a little bit in love with it and passionate about it, a little bit devoted to it. So I think that is the fuel of our journey, is love, or all of those synonyms of love, devotion, intensity, ambition, appetite, curiosity. All of those words are in the same family. And if we're not manifesting that passion, if we're bored by our work, or if we're just sort of members of our society, and this is a pretty passionless society, if we're not manifesting that passion, we probably don't have enough motivational juice to do our writing. It's hard to write from just mere interest. Mere interest peters out pretty quickly.
You bet your ass it does. I've tried writing things I was sort of interested in, and I'm reminded of the Mark Twain quote. You know, he had a great quote, which is, the difference, I'm sure you've heard this one, but the difference between the right word and the almost right word is the difference between lightning and a lightning bug. Well, I feel that way about a book where you're passionate about and where you're kind of passionate about. It's like being in love with a woman and almost being in love with her, and it's a huge
difference.
Yeah, and
you know, that's right, and when you use a word like lightning, a lot of people are scared of words like that, like lightning or exhaustion or passion or, you know, those kinds of words people find them a little bit dangerous. You know, anxiety is is part of our warning system against danger. It makes a lot of people a little anxious to think about being that passionate. It feels a little dangerous. But we need that. As I say, we don't need it just for some abstract reason. We need it because mere interest is not going to sustain us in our work.
No. No. I always feel like, you know, concert musicians, people who go on to be able to play at a very high level, they have to, obviously they're dedicated, obviously they're willing to practice even on the days where they frankly would like to go have a cup of coffee and just talk to their friends. They're going to practice anyway, but they must love the very feel of the strings on their fingers. They must love what it feels like to have the thing against their chin, what it sounds like. They have to love that, every experience of it, to be willing to return to it again and again and again. I don't think without that level of love, you would commit that many hours. Eventually, the slave driver would give up, and so would you.
That's right. And Rubinstein, the pianist, said, you know, if you need me to play the notes exactly correctly, I can't make music.
Yeah.
Which is interesting, because we're making music, so to speak. We're trying to do something, you know, truthful and beautiful. And it's not about perfection. It's not about exactness. It's about being in love with this enterprise. And if we're not in love with this enterprise, yeah, we can do work. We can sit there and white-knuckle some number of words. But that's not our most authentic calling.
No, absolutely not. Now, let me ask you a question, Eric. What is it about coaching people that excites you and that draws out your passion?
Well, I love the progress that folks make. Well, probably a lot of different reasons. The first is most creative people do not feel supported at all.
Yeah.
They don't. It's hard in the marketplace, as you know. It's hard to feel supported in the marketplace. Even if you have a literary agent or an editor or what have you, it's still hard to feel really connected in the marketplace. And most people don't even have that, don't have editors and literary agents and what have you. You can't really talk to the people around you about the work you do for tons of reasons. But one odd reason is that the folks around you don't have a sufficient vocabulary of praise. You know, you want the people in your life to love what you're doing, and they only know how to say that they like things. Yeah, I liked it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, if your husband says he liked your story, you're going to kill him. It's just too small a thing that he's saying.
Yeah.
So if you're not finding support in the marketplace, if you're not finding support from the people around you, where are you going to find support? I think it's just a lovely role to play, to be of support to folks who don't have much support in their life. That's A. And then B is it's just lovely to see progress. It's lovely to see somebody start out with a kind of incoherent or amorphous idea for a novel and then 3 years later get it published. I think that's lovely, and I enjoy doing that work.
Yeah. And it does ask something of you, too, because coaching is a great process, isn't it? You have to step up with each client and really get present and really tune in to be of use to them in that moment and not just repeat what you did with the client before.
There's that, and there's also the accountability piece. I think coaching is a pretty simple thing to describe. It's supporting people and holding them accountable. So you have to be, so to speak, strong enough to tell clients that this doesn't make sense, that doesn't make sense, can they try this, can they try that? They claimed they were going to do this week and they didn't pull it off. What are they going to try this? In other words, to be honest and straightforward with clients and also to offer suggestions, try to solve problems, and to lead. Coaching is a dance where, you know, the client leads and the coach leads sometimes. You can go back and forth as to who is the leader in the relationship. But a lot of new coaches don't feel comfortable with the idea of holding their clients accountable. They want to, so to speak, have it be a very smiley relationship. But things don't get done in just a pure smiley relationship.
Yes, you do have to say that there's a goal of some kind, that they're going to shoot
that's
for.
Right. And that's right. And the client gets to pick the goal. It's not my business to pick the goals, but there do have to be goals. We have to know what we're attempting to get done, and naturally the goals shift and change as life circumstances change or as the goals don't get met. Naturally that all shifts and changes, but you do need goals.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you mentioned a word. This was what I was just earlier, and I wanted to bring up number 7 in your 9 keys, which is the relationship key. Now, how does that factor into the creative process?
Well, here I'm talking primarily about relationships in the marketplace. I've written about artisan intimate relationships elsewhere, and this is more about relationships in the marketplace. And the idea that, you know, most creative folks stand in odd relationship to marketplace players. They put them on a pedestal. They also kind of loathe them.
Yeah.
they realize that they hold, you know, too much power. And in fact, lots of marketplace players, because power does corrupt, are not so nice. They can be, you know, ruder than they need to be, and, you know, things that they don't need to be. So what I'm talking about in that key and what I want clients and readers to understand is that it's on their shoulders to get in the shoes of marketplace players and understand what they need from them. Because it's so hard to make it in the arts, each individual writer is going to have to prove the exception. The rule is you're not going to make it. So if you don't want to be just another statistic of not making it, you have to prove the exception. And one of the exceptional things to try is to understand what marketplace players want, to get a better picture of what their difficulties are, what their needs are, and to make use of that. I'll give you a simple example. You know, if a literary agent is getting hundreds of emails a day with subject lines like, you know, please represent me, and is deleting them as fast as they come in, once you get a clear picture of that and you see how difficult it is for a literary agent to deal with those hundreds of incoming emails, suddenly,
yeah,
I think, becomes clear to you that your subject line better be interesting. It better stand out. You know, it's crazy if your chance of publication hinges on the quality of the subject line of your email, but these are the kinds of things that one has to get better at. And these are some of the ideas that I have in mind when I talk about artists in relationship with the marketplace.
Yeah, that's a really good point, and I'm glad you brought it up. And I think that, you know, one of the important steps for me was when I went to my first writers' conference. And the reason is I'm kind of a people person. I like talking to people. I like relating, even though writing, I so love to write, which is a experience. I love people, and I understand the world through relationships. That's really how I get the world. And that was the problem I had with the marketing end of writing, because it seemed so devoid of human beings, because it was always me sending letters and it's,
yep,
inhuman. But then I went to the writers' conferences for the first time, and I said, that's right, they're people. They're people, and I recognize them, and I know what they're like, and I just need to put them in a cat or understand them as I understand everybody. And it started becoming more integrated into my life, as opposed to this weird separate experience that wasn't a part of anything else I did, that they're just human beings with their own needs and all the other things.
That's right, and they have their shadows, and they are, they're exactly,
yeah,
human beings. And what's lovely for us is that we don't need 27,000 of them to like us. We need one or two advocates. You know, we,
yeah,
need one literary agent at a time. We need one editor at a time. So we're not,
yeah,
looking to form relationships with 163 million people, but we need to know how to form relationships with those one or two or three or four people. We need to be savvier, and we need to not come from our own shadowy places. You know, a lot of people are meeker than they need to be, and a lot of people are more aggressive than they need to be, and neither of those two polar positions help us all that much.
And you have to trust that what you have to offer is of value. You mean, in the end, you've got to be your leader. You have to know, because you're the one who's created it. You're the one who has to believe in it when no one else does. You've got to believe that what you saw valuable is valuable. And that
right.
will,
and
you can believe it.
That's right. And your default position with respect to feedback from the universe is to trust your own opinion. And that's easy to say, but not so easy to do.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if an agent or an editor sort of cavalierly sends you an email and says, well, your book's okay, but it's a little slow, it's hard not to take that seriously. And we have,
yeah,
to be careful not to take those kinds of cavalier offhand comments seriously, because, you know, you send the same manuscript to the next agent and, you know, you'll get a completely different take on it. So we have to, as I say, it's hard to do, but we have to not take too seriously all the feedback and comments we get from the marketplace. We have to trust our own opinion and, as you say, befriend our work and be an advocate for our work.
It's so true. Boy, I could talk to you for another hour and a half, but I know our time is running out. I want to make sure people know where to find you, Eric. If people want to find you, what's the best and quickest way to play go?
Quickest way is my site, and that's ericmaisel.com. That's ericmaisel.com. Lots of information there on writing workshops I do all over the world and creativity coaching trainings and all sorts of things.
And I assume you can do coaching over the phone or over Skype, whatever. Now they don't have to go face-to-face with you.
I don't have any face-to-face clients anymore. It's all phone, Skype, and email. That's right.
Oh, that's the brave new world. Well, Eric, this has been great. Thank you so much for your advice and perspective, and best of luck with making your creative mark. I'm sure it'll do great.
Thanks so much for having me. Take care now.
All right. You're welcome. Well, everybody, there you go. Another great New World Library author, Mr. Eric Maisel, making your creative mark. Get out there and get it. In the meantime, I will be the guest next week, or I'll be in conversation with Terry Persun about writing within yourself, that favorite topic of mine. Until then, do what you love, love what you love, love who you love, and you really can't go wrong, can you? Bye, everybody.